saying, wah, 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 intro music. Beep, 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 beep. Welcome to the Bass and Treble Podcast. My name is Neil.
And I'm Steve. And this is an audio file for audio files.
And this week we're going to discuss In Utero, Nirvana's third and final studio album and one of my personal favorites.
And then after that, we're going to talk about Buddy Holly. We're going to talk about David Bowie selling out. We're going to talk about James Brown's business practices and John Lennon's Hollywood star.
And if you haven't subscribed, go ahead and do that. Plus, you can follow us on Twitter at Bass Treble Pod. Like us on Facebook, Bass and Treble Podcast, for more daily content.
All right. So, yeah, this week's album is In Utero by Nirvana. Why'd you pick this one?
I had a discussion with a friend of mine that wasn't you, and I was talking to him about Nirvana, and he recommended some other Nirvana album, and we were talking about, what's your favorite Nirvana album? I was like, In Utero, and I was thinking to myself, this is a great album. It's my favorite Nirvana album, probably the best collection of music that Kurt Cobain put together as just a songwriter. Everybody talks about Nevermind, I guess, but it has some great songs and it has some great staying power, as you would consider the best songs on the album. A lot of these things still come on rock radio stations and definitely college radio stations. Would you agree?
No, actually, I would completely disagree. I haven't dropped this bomb on you yet, but out of all the Nirvana albums, this is the one that I dislike the most.
Okay, fair enough.
It has a few decent songs on there. Most of the ones are the ones that I like from their Unplugged album anyways. But it's the songs that aren't their hits that to me are just like boring.
Okay.
And boring and like yelly, screamy. They all kind of sound the same kind of way. To me, this is Nirvana at the end. You know, like Kurt Cobain was high on heroin most of the time when he was writing these. And they just don't strike me as his best work. Of course, Nevermind is their number one album. I think a lot of
right.
people can agree.
I mean,
with
my
that.
Favorite song, my favorite Nirvana song is Something in the Way, which is from Nevermind.
Right. And then there's Bleach. I almost even like Bleach even more than this album.
I feel like all the songs on Bleach were done better live. Like all of them are just done better live in live recordings, right? Because Bleach has School, has what, Love Buzz, right? That's from Bleach. So, you know, I think when you look at a band like Nirvana, they really don't have too many albums.
Came in hard and then turned into the Foo Fighters.
Not anybody's fault. I mean, you know, of all the people in Nirvana, Dave Grohl, yeah, he's the most open, like, I don't want to talk about it.
Do you think it's because he gets asked about it all the time, or do you think it's because it's like a hard part in his life to
talk
about?
I think it's a really hard life. I think it's a really hard part of his life to talk about. I think it's something that when you talk about losing a friend like that, I mean, Steve, I don't want to lose you. I wouldn't want to talk about that shit after.
I ain't going nowhere, man.
It's just one of those things that, you know, I guess when you try to go do your own thing musically after, it probably does get annoying, but I think it's more than anything just a sensitivity thing. He just doesn't want to talk about it. It's like respect for the dead type of thing.
Okay.
The thing that I give Kurt Cobain credit for is that the stuff that his lyrics were about, like we were just talking about, we were talking about Setless Apprentice, which is my favorite song on this album. Just the guitar, the drums, musically, it's just such a badass song for me. It's just a really has a good high and low. But seriously, Like Most Babies Smell Like Butter. I mean, come on. Like, that's just, like, nobody but Kurt Cobain could have written that.
It's just proof of where he was in his life. I mean, like, that's totally the kind of lyrics you come up with when you are drugged out of your mind.
I think part of your, you know, not to discredit what you're saying, but I think part of your consciousness is taken aback by the drug stuff.
Well, yeah, I did just recently see the montage of Heck, and there's plenty of that in there.
I just think the guy was a genius. So, you know, looking at the songs that we noted here, Heart-Shaped Box, Rape Me, Dumb, Penny Royalty, All Apologies. So right there, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 songs that are all really great songs. It's what, a 12-song album?
It's right, and I'm not denying that. Half the album is awesome. The other half is him complaining about being famous at this point. This is not what he wanted. I mentioned with last week's album, too, you know, how it starts out, like, really with a kicker. It really starts out, like, strong. And then on this album, the very first few lines of the very first song, yeah, it says, "Teenage angst has paid off well, now I'm bored and old." By the time he released this album, he was, like, over it already.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's so honest, and if you look at Nirvana and who they, like Kurt Cobain, who he was, man, he was just going against the grain. Like, all the bands that he inspired are all bands that go against major label-type distribution sound and lyrics. And I, this is the thing about Nirvana that's kind of funny. Like, I watched Montage of Heck 2, and I think we both kind of thought it was a great movie, and right, like, it had a lot of crazy going on, but it was just a really put-together story of his life. Even though he's, like, this skinny, like, doesn't, you know, fit the mold type of guy, I think his bitchy lyrics don't sound bitchy to me. Like, when I listen to Nirvana, and maybe it's just the whole band, right? Like, it just, they're bitchy songs about, you know, teenage angst and about teenage this and I hate my dad, and but he doesn't sound like a pussy. And it's funny because it's like you watch that movie and you think he struggled with being viewed as a pussy, right? I mean, there's other bands that have come out in the 2000s that are the same, that are not the same, but are whiny and talking about, you know, I hate my dad, but they all sound like that, like, I hate my mom.
You sound like Blink-182 right there.
Right, Blink-182, you know, I don't know, not to hate, but come on. Compare Blink-182's approach to bitching about their life to Kurt Cobain's badass, like, voice. That's just like, even in Sales Apprentice, when he's screaming go away, it just, it's so guttural. And I'm just like, I want to go away now. And
there's
then, like,
passion behind it.
There is, man. And the guitar comes back in. I'll tell you this, like, for what he was singing about in lyrics, yeah, you could kind of discredit him and say, like, yeah, dude, you were, like, you're a famous rock star and now you're burning out and this is what you're talking about. But he played guitar like a, he's totally, like, discounted as a guitar player. Just, like, complete and utter disregard for his instrument. For lack of a better term, he makes it his like, he doesn't allow, like, you know, like, guitarist, like, for example, I love Pearl Jam, right? Mm-hmm. But you know every Pearl Jam song, minus save maybe 2 or 3, have this, like, you know, typical 90s guitar solo section or whatever. Mm-hmm. A Kurt Cobain guitar solo sounds like a train wreck, but the whole band, like, sounds great. Like, it just makes no sense. He has such a distinct sound, and, I mean, he played through, what, a Fender Jaguar. And every time I go to a guitar store, I grab one of these guitars, and it's just like, dude, this guy played this beast-ass Fender, weighs 1,000 pounds.
Was he left-handed, too?
He was totally left-handed, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He goes down in that club. He's got the left-handed club. He's got the Forever 27 club.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like that shitty little poster that you get at the Hot Topic, right?
I had that.
Did you have that? Up.
Yeah.
It was like, it was him, Janis Joplin,
Jimi Hendrix.
And Jim Morrison.
Yeah, what I liked is that all these, you know, old school legends were, like, hanging out around the table. And then on the other side of the room, you see Kurt Cobain kind of walking through the door like, hi, guys, I'm here. Like, I'm one of you guys now.
Yeah.
And
wow.
I kind of wanted them to remake that poster again, only when Amy Winehouse passed away. I think she was also 27.
True.
And it would have been great to see that same kind of poster, only with Kurt Cobain at that point hanging out and being his own legend. And then Amy Winehouse showing up at the door, be like, hi guys, I'm here.
So how much? So between all these songs, do you have a favorite between Heart-Shaped Box, Rape Me, Dumb? Dumb to me is like the best. Dumb is such a cool song, man. Like, I think I'm dumb. It's such a cool song.
It's like a
sing
along. It's like, yeah, everybody, repeat after me. I think I'm dumb. I think I'm dumb. I think I'm dumb. No, I like All Apologies for a lot of reasons. It's like just groovy and chill. the All Apologies on the Unplugged soundtrack. To me, it was the best. And there's this moment, if you're watching the video, at the end of All Apologies, where he gives this look, and it's like a spooky, eerie look, because it was only a month after that was when he killed himself, and he gives this look at the end, the very last moment of the last song on Unplugged. If you look, he gives this like cold stare when you just know he's like over it. He's just done with it. He doesn't want to be there. He's sick of it. And I think that the whole year leading up to that, this album came out in September 1993, and it was April 94 is when, you know, just those few months later that they did the Unplugged show. And then it was like, I think very shortly after that is when he died.
Yeah, you've always mentioned that to me. You've always mentioned to me that look, and I know exactly what you're talking about. He just kind of has, he does this like little smile with a blank stare into the crowd, like he's not really smiling. It's almost like a grimace of pain.
Yeah, it's cold. It's eerie.
All Apologies is one of the first songs that I was really happy to learn on the guitar because it's just super fun.
The only video I remember for this was Heart-Shaped Box, and that one was kind of spooky too. That was
That's the one I'm thinking of. The one in the garden, right? That he's like laying down in the garden and it's like artsy.
Yeah, it kind of goes along with the album cover too. You get that person, you could like see all their muscles and stuff. I think there was a few scenes with some sort of Cupid in there.
Yeah.
It was interesting at the time.
Yeah, kind of interesting because nowadays artists come out with music videos kind of like underground. Like people don't even watch them.
Actually, yes. Vevo is the place to go. It's integrated with YouTube, but yeah, there are some times where I just like go through and browse and see what's new on Vevo and see what's old on Vevo. It reminded me why music videos are cool, because I can hear a song a million times, but once I watch the video, it sinks in a whole different way. You actually pay attention to the words a whole lot more, you get the storyline of the video, and it adds an extra dimension to the music that you normally wouldn't get if you just listen to it. So I love watching music videos.
Or it's the other way around, where you watch the music video and you wish you'd never seen it, and you're like,
you can never unsee it.
Yeah, totally. Something comes to mind with that. Ace of Base, The Sign. Dumbest. I love that song.
What a classic example.
Dumbass music video. I'm just like, wow, you guys, I can't believe you guys put time into this shit.
Well, I don't know what you really expected from them.
So what we liked up to, you know, what you said you liked was that half of the album is great and half of the album is just whiny. Okay, I got you. And then you had a note here about Cobain, about how they wanted, you know, the record companies, I guess he's speaking about, wanted another Nevermind, but he'd rather die than do that. Well, he did that and then died. Like, I just posted an article on our Facebook page about Francis Bean. I'm sorry, on Twitter. Look at me, my social networking. On Twitter, I'd retweeted an article I found about Frances Bean Cobain saying she doesn't even like Nirvana that much and said the society just glorifies dead musicians. Like a thing like, oh yeah, my dad's part of the culture, but you know, he died and that's why he's so famous.
But I read that article in, you know, in its totality, and it goes a little bit more in depth how it almost kind of makes her feel like what we were talking about with Dave Grohl before. Like, you know, it's a painful part of your history and it's everywhere. You can't turn on the radio without hearing some Nirvana song. And when you go through your entire life like that, I can imagine it could be pretty difficult on her. She's just like, I don't want to deal with it anymore.
So, that and your mom is Courtney Love.
Right? Makes you a little bit crazy to begin with.
Yeah, so I think 100%, 110%, my opinion is that Nirvana was a better band live. Anytime I've seen concert footage of them, any live recordings I've heard, they were a kick-ass live band. Like, say anything you want about Kurt Cobain's drug habits and anything like that, and Kurt Cobain's like personal life being a wreck, I think he was an awesome bandmate, and I think he was just a great musician, and he never made any fucking excuses. I mean, the beginning of Montage of Heck, when he gets walked out on the wheelchair, and I guess that was right after he came out of rehab, right? And he gets up, and he's like, "Some say love is a river." Falls on the floor. It's like, I would have loved to be at a concert where there's a guy who's that's crazy that, like, he's
just entertaining. It's entertainment. And he knew what he was doing.
Exactly. It wasn't like a thing that he just was hoping it would stick.
He was a little more calculated than that.
I think he was, yeah, I think he was very calculated. And I think he also maybe, and this is something that I think musicians, probably Roger Waters is the closest to someone who's actually said they've done something in a concert about it. I think musicians like certain fans more than others. Like, he always complained about Smells Like Teen Spirit and having to play it. Like, who wouldn't? Like, Robert Plant complained about Stairway to Heaven, right, bro? Like, he hated Stairway to Heaven.
When it's part of every single night and you're like contractually obligated to play it, I can see how it
would. So your opinion is like you should love your fans and you should be all about it, right?
I'm not saying that either.
So I think they're better live. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that it's the kind of energy that you can't get through the studio. I think studio is a good place to, you know, perfect your sound, but these guys had the kind of energy that comes through in a live show. And I actually had a chance to see it with my own eyes. They played Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction last year at the Barclays Center. And it was the first time Nirvana played together as a band without Kurt Cobain. So instead, they just brought on all these female vocalists. They brought on Lorde for All Apologies. Joan Jett got to sing Smells Like Teen Spirit. The girl from St. Vincent came up and sang some songs. And had the entire place roaring. I mean, for obvious reasons, it's Nirvana. But beyond that, they're just like, they're entertainers. And that went on, you know, through Foo Fighters and everything. They know how to bring the energy. And Dave Grohl is still doing it to this day. He could break his leg on stage and still have the crowd, like, completely head over heels cheering for him. And that started, probably was even more pronounced when they were younger and had more energy.
Do you think he's just going to stay in that chair from now on? Like, it's become a part of him. Like, he's got his leg out and he's, like, playing and he's rocking just as good. But, like, I know it's not as easy to sing sitting down as it is standing up. So I know that a part of him is like, I can't wait to stand up again. Like, this is so annoying.
What I didn't realize is that they named the tour after his broken leg. I was waiting on the subway this morning, and there was a dude in front of me getting on, and I was reading the back of his shirt. It said, Foo Fighters Broken Leg Tour. And it had, you know, all the concert dates. It was a concert t-shirt. But they named it after his broken leg, and it's not getting in his way.
Did you see that video? And I know it's getting off topic, but did you see that video of, like, that whole town in Italy playing Learn to Fly?
Yeah, that was pretty sweet.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was cool that they did it. It sounded like a train wreck to me because I'm just like, whoa, there's way too many drums and guitar players and bass players. And I even told somebody was like, oh yeah, it's great that they all did that. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that they've mixed down a few of these guys. I have a hard time believing that. They captured everyone, but they looked pretty good. Like, everybody looked like they were on beat. Everybody had their headphones on.
And it just looked like a good time with good energy.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we'll throw a link up to that on our
social
media.
Yeah, we should.
Sites.
And I bet you anything that, like, water was like $15 a bottle there, because anytime you get that many people, you've got to charge a lot for water. Right, Steve?
Maybe they just get to bring their own water.
So, similar artists and albums compared to Nirvana. I mean, Pearl Jam, right? Pearl Jam's a big favorite of mine. What's your favorite Pearl Jam song? Totally off topic. What's your favorite Pearl Jam song? You got one?
Ooh, you got to give me time to prepare for something like that.
Come on, you know one. You know one. You know your favorite one.
How about Yellow Ledbetter?
Oh, my. You can't understand anything he's saying, but it's a great
song.
That's
why I love it. You can make up any words you want to it and just sing along. You're never wrong.
It's a good song. My favorite is Go. I love Go. That's
a powerful song. It's just like raw. It's energy.
Yeah, it's just a weird, I like it. I like the way the guitar sounds. So Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, and Pixies were four that that you had suggested here. I guess Nirvana influenced these bands more than was contemporaries, right? I mean, they were kind of in line, but not really.
They were all kind of part of the same scene, I think. I wasn't there, so I really can't speak about what happened in Seattle in the 90s. But from
what
I
understand... Well, you've seen SLC Punk a few times, so we all know what
happened.
I've
seen Singles. Singles is a huge Eddie Vedder, and the whole team is in there.
Right.
Yeah, and the Pixies, actually, I've been getting into a little bit more lately. I saw them at the Shaky Knees Festival and had a really good time. They've been around for longer than Nirvana. They inspired Nirvana, and you can totally tell when you hear that music. It's like post-punk, pre-grunge, and some kind of a mix in between, I think.
Can you say that again? Post-punk, pre-grunge?
Yeah, it took me a second to get those words in order.
I was just going to mention, I'm looking at this website. Before I go into what I was wanting to talk about, because I wanted to mention bands that kind of have taken on the Nirvana baton and move, you know, kind of forward with it that were not maybe contemporaries.
All right, who's on that list?
Well, before I get to this list, have you ever been on a website and there's like, you know, the stupid side ads, like link bait articles?
Yes, right? Where are you going with this?
So one of these says, toddler with swollen head desperately needs surgery. And this is like seriously a Cabbage Patch Kid with a Band-Aid on its head.
Doesn't that make you want to click on it?
No, because I'm just like, what? That's not a baby? Like, what are you doing?
Swollen head. What kind of website are you visiting here?
This is HuffPost. This is the Huffington Post, man.
Quality programming.
The venerable HuffPost. So yeah, Death Cab for Cutie, Green Day, Muse.
Wow. All right.
What do you think? Let's
break these apart. Let's go one at a time. You said Death Cab for Cutie.
Yep. Green Day.
No, one at a time. Death Cab for Cutie.
So Death Cab for Cutie. Do you think they? I mean, they're from Seattle, right? They make great records.
Yeah, but that might be where the similarities stop. Just because you're from Seattle doesn't mean that you're anything like Nirvana.
But they're indie, and Nirvana was indie. Let's be real. Nirvana was an indie band that made it. They were absolutely indie.
But also, the concept of alternative music has changed over time. Alternative in the 90s is not what alternative is today.
Do you think Green Day classifies as someone who's continued the Nirvana baton?
Yeah. They had the fast riffs. They had the power chords. They had the bar chords. They are
and
much
they were,
closer to
and
Nirvana.
They were singing, and they were singing, whining about teenage issues, right?
Yeah. I see infinitely more similarities than Death Cab.
Okay. What about Radiohead? As equally influential as Nirvana?
All right. Influential is a different story.
Okay.
But in terms of style, it's close. It's 90s alternative.
I think they're more experimental than Nirvana.
And a lot more versatile, too.
Right. This is what we talked about last week, the White Stripes. What I mean, do you think the White Stripes have continued the Nirvana baton? Do you think they've classified as someone who's passed the baton was passed to them in some way?
One word. Yes, and here's why. Distortion.
I'm just going to leave it at that. Like, I can't reply because that was just a perfect answer.
I want to know what your thoughts are.
I think you're right. That's all. That's all I have to say about that. All
right, we'll leave it at that.
Let's jump into This Week in Music History. You know, we talked about Nirvana. I think we had a good conversation. I'm glad we didn't totally agree on In Utero, and I still think it's probably the best album they ever had. But that's just me.
You're entitled to that opinion.
That's cool. And so is everybody else listening to this podcast. Don't let Steve tell you different. And the one person who's going to keep listening to it till the very end. We know who you are. So yeah, we were talking about David Bowie selling out earlier. Steve, why don't you go ahead and run us through what that means? Because I think it was riddled in mystery.
Do you use your pointy nipples as telescopic antennae to transmit data back to Earth?
Bet you do, you freaky old bastard, you.
Hey Bowie, do you have one really funky sequence spacesuit? Or do you have several changes?
Do you smack grass out in space, Bowie? Or do they smoke AstroTurf? Receiving transmission from David Bowie's nipple antenna. Do you read me, Lieutenant Bowie?
Just like everything David Bowie does.
Bowie's in space!
Right, so the year was 1972. It's like right around the time of Ziggy Stardust. David Bowie played New York's Carnegie Hall, and it was the first time he ever sold out in the U.S.
Isn't that insane? I mean, he had to come and sell out here. He was already doing his thing in the UK.
He was big over there.
I mean, but think of how freaky it was. David Bowie's first sellout in New York. Like, this is 72. Like, cocaine really hasn't taken a grasp, right, in the U.S. yet? Like, it's not as popular.
They were fresh out of the 60s.
Oh, I mean, okay.
They were still, you know, dealing with, you know, the Beatles breakup and... And David Bowie comes around with his Spiders from Mars, which I still think to this day is unbeatable as a band name.
Isn't it amazing to call your band Spiders from Mars? What compares to that? Like, what other band names are that odd, Spiders from Mars?
I'm thinking of Prince and the New Power Generation. I mean, that's an interesting band name.
It sounds like a division of Greenpeace. The New Power Generation.
Sounds like a team of superheroes. Somewhat like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
I'm thinking more around the lines of Captain Planet.
I'll go with that.
And the Planeteers. The Power Generation. Sweet. And you know what's pretty odd to me that I found out was that the song Space Oddity, which if for those of you that don't know what song that is, which I hope none of you are my friends, it's the one that goes Ground Control to Major Tom and all that. That came out in 69. His first sellout in the U.S. was in 72. That's quite a jump. A little over 3 years, and that song came out in the U.K. 3 years earlier. So he wasn't like an instant success, right? Like he wasn't just like coming over here and barnstorming the U.S.
He actually had to work for it.
You know, in September 92, he was still pretty much an unknown quantity in the U.S., and none of his singles or LPs had even appeared in the U.S. charts. And so it was really important for him to succeed in New York. So there's a lot of promotion at Carnegie Hall, obviously. That's how they sold out. Even Andy Warhol's play Pork was used as a way to distribute tickets to the largest and most influential counterculture participants there in New York City back in 1972.
I could see some similarities there in terms of the demographic. Andy Warhol plus David Bowie, it's all the same people.
There's a song on the album Ziggy Stardust called Andy Warhol.
Makes a lot of sense.
And he sang it to Andy Warhol. That's pretty good. And just, you know, to kind of bring it all together, Flight of the Conchords did a song about Bowie.
So did Syphil and Ollie.
Did they really? I didn't know that. Why didn't you bring that to the table? That needs to be brought to the table, Steve. Sock puppets need to be part of this podcast.
Now you know.
Remember when we went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and they had his jumpsuit?
Yeah, his whole costume set up. That was sweet.
Remember how freaking skinny he is? Like, just how skinny that costume was, man? Like, it was so small. All right, so moving on. What else happened? Let me do this one, right? So James Brown had his band walk out on him in Hallandale, Florida back in 1977 because they were complaining about being underpaid and overworked.
I find this funny because James Brown nickname was the hardest working man in show business. And then the people that he's working with are claiming they were overworked. So it kind of makes sense. Look who you're working with.
Yeah, and he's not the first person that I've heard do this. George Clinton also famously would not pay his musicians and they would complain about it. And George Clinton actually was like kind of a thug. He was like a gangster.
George Clinton had 20 people to support. You ever seen him up on stage? It's a party up there all the time.
So this is what I had to say about this incident, which I don't know if you knew, but I thought was pretty awesome.
What's that?
So this is in 1977, his band walked out on him. Well, it turns out that the same thing happened 7 years earlier, in March of 1970. And basically, Bootsy Collins and his older brother, Phelps Collins, whose name was Catfish, which I think is awesome, and a couple other cool cats, they started a funk band called the Pacemakers. And they basically got a call from the manager like, hey man, the Godfather wants y'all to back him up. And they were like, what? Like, James Brown? Seriously? And they went as the JBs. So Bootsy Collins and his band was the band who played Get Up, I Feel Like Being a Sex Machine. Is that not cool?
Bootsy Collins had an awesome name for his band. Wasn't it like the Rubber Band?
I don't know, Steve.
Bootsy Collins Rubber Band was the name of his band.
This is in 1968, and they switched a lot of bands, but Bootsy Collins is obviously one of the like most badass funk bass players ever, right? And he played on Get Up, Feel Like Being a Sex Machine, like James Brown's most popular song he was recording.
I have some good news about funk, actually. I got a video message. My sister's in Austria right now.
Yeah.
And she was in an elevator that looked outside, and she took a video of the elevator because you see some beautiful sights out there. And it was great and all, but the part of the video that really struck me was the music playing in the background. She's in some crazy elevator in a hotel in Austria, and they're playing the funkiest funk music I have ever heard. And it was just reassuring to know that, you know, funk is worldwide and universal.
Hell yeah. We want the funk. Give up the funk.
Gotta have that funk.
Ow. Bop, 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 bada.
So there's one other event in music history I want to talk about, and it has to do with John Lennon. It was this week in 1988 when he got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Just in time for his birthday, which is next week. He would have been 75 years old this year.
Wow.
While we're talking about music history and John Lennon's star on the Walk of Fame, 2 years ago this week, it was defaced. They found it in the morning, and there was a smiley face all over it, and a mushroom, of course.
So what low-life piece of garbage get faces John Lennon's Hollywood Walk of Fame star?
Hippies.
Yeah, whatever. I don't wanna say what the person looked like, but I bet you they were of the hippie generation.
The hippie variety.
But do you think they liked John Lennon? Like, do you think they did it and they're like, I love John Lennon, and they did it? Or were they just like, I've got some stupid factoid about John Lennon and I'm gonna scribble this shit on his gravestone? What do you think?
No, it was a smiley face and a mushroom. I think that they were total John Lennon fans. They were probably just
stoned out of their minds.
You took the words out of my mouth.
There you go. I don't like to take things out of people's mouths, Steve.
Well, luckily they're only words.
Keep your teeth in your mouth. So yeah, and so what's the deal? So they defaced it, and really, really awesome factoid here, right? I keep saying factoid. I don't know what's going on.
It's just facts, man.
I keep thinking of Altoids or something. Like, factoid! It's not a fact. What is the difference between a fact and a factoid?
Let's save that for another episode.
All right, why don't we? Yeah, we'll bring that up. We'll research it and bring it up. So John Lennon was inducted in 1988. He passed away in 1980. And he was the first of the four Beatles to be inducted. Following him was George Harrison in 2009. I'm not sure. I don't recall what year George Harrison passed away, but I think it was in the early 2000s. Then Ringo Starr in 2010. And then finally, Paul McCartney in 2012.
Finally.
Which, to summarize, basically means everybody hates Paul. Everybody hates Paul.
Even Ringo got his start before Paul.
Well, like, Ringo had more number one hits, like, than any of them, apparently. Like, he penned so many hits, and he was apparently had a better solo career than anybody on that list, believe it or not.
Have you never heard of Wings?
I have, and I love Wings. Not, I don't know. I like Band on the Run. I think Band on the Run is a cool song. I think Jet, it has its moments. I think it's very dated. I think Band on the Run is like a timeless song, but I think Jet is, it's a little too much. And then what's that other song? The Traveling, whatever the heck, Traveling Wilburys?
Oh, Traveling Wilburys. That was George Harrison with, like, who was in there? Tom Petty, Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Like, everybody.
Yeah, that was a super group.
Everybody with weird hair was in that band. They were, like, the weird hair band. Hippies. Yeah, Tom Petty, like, as much as I like Tom Petty, what's up with his hair? Like, he gets older, but his hair stays the same age. He's got that same, like, mushroom cut. He kind of looks like Willy Wonka with blonde hair.
Well, I can't really blame him. My haircut hasn't changed in probably just as long.
So do any of these events, did they have any effect on your life whatsoever?
Well, I think anything that happens in John Lennon's life affects me in some minute way.
Yeah, somebody messed with his, you know, star, whatever, Steve. You live, like, close to Strawberry Fields, all right? I'm jealous. I love that place.
And, yeah, I heard that next week they're trying to make the Guinness Book of World Records to make the biggest human peace sign ever. They're trying to get, like, 10,000 people out to Central Park on John Lennon's birthday on October 6th. And all to stand in Central Park and make, like, a really huge peace sign. If it wasn't in the middle of the day, you know I'd be there.
So do all the people that used to be at Occupy Wall Street coordinate these events? Because seriously,
they all just gather around.
We want to make the world's biggest peace sign because we want the terrorists to be able to target us from space.
No, this one's backed by Yoko.
Oh, really?
This is Yoko's deal.
I have, you know, I don't have anything against Yoko Ono except her singing. Like, if she just wouldn't ever.
She's a great person except her voice.
Yeah, stop. Just stop it. All right, so. So, Steve, you picked the artist from any decade to discuss this week. And what decade, what artist? Shoot. Any artist from any decade, go.
Buddy Holly.
What decade is that?
50s.
You weren't even a twinkle in your grandfather's eye. What a sweet, sweet dude. I know him for his glasses. I know him for his music. I think Buddy Holly had more of an influence on popular culture than people give him credit for.
Which is surprising, because he only had two major hits. Mm-hmm. That'll Be the Day That I Die, and of course, Peggy Sue.
Peggy Sue's an amazing song, right?
But is it so amazing that it's going to carry Buddy Holly's legacy, like, forever?
Yeah, pretty much. I think, again, this is a glorification of an artist who died early and had a lot of potential, right? Have you ever seen Walk the Line?
Johnny Cash, yeah.
Did you see Buddy Holly was on that? Buddy Holly used to travel with with them when they were doing the circuit. Buddy Holly, Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis.
It was a crew back in the day.
Yeah, man, taking Quaaludes or whatever the hell the pills were back then and getting crazy.
I'm on the subject of, like, band names tonight, and I like Buddy Holly's because he had the Cricket. That was the name of his backup band.
It sounds like a boring band, doesn't it?
It's definitely not the Spiders from Mars.
Yeah, no. Well, now in context, Spiders from Mars sounds like a disease band. Like, they sound a lot heavier compared to the Crickets.
Crickets sound boring, but there was also this thing in the 50s and 60s where bands would just take animals and make it their name. Like, there was the Turtles, the Birds, the Monkeys, the Beatles, which was kind of at least a play on words. That got a little crazy. The Zombies.
I know I'm going to sound really stupid, but I just right now realized the Beatles and the Beatles.
How old are you? How long did this take?
I'm 29 years old, and I just now figured it out, because I figure their music just kind of made them, and they could have been called whatever. But there is something to a name. There is something to a band name. Yeah, but Peggy Sue had that, man, that was just such a, like, rockabilly song, and that drum roll in it. Everything. You gotta remember, back in the day, Steve, like guitars, there was no distortion sound. The way that people got, like, distortion on their guitar was just to turn the volume super, super high.
He looked too nerdy to, like, crank it up. He seemed like a little do-goody kind of guy.
Like a presentable young man. And like, I guess that made parents think that he was, like, safe for their kids, but he secretly wasn't. That's something that artists have been doing for a long time. I mean, look at Miley Cyrus. We all thought she was okay. And now... I mean, I went to go something I was doing on Twitter, and I saw what her album cover looks like, and it looks like a box of crayons exploded in her face or something, and I just don't get it.
You have got to see her mashup with, or her collaboration with, the Flaming Lips. There has never been anything more psychedelic on the face of this earth.
Really?
It doesn't even make sense.
I wouldn't expect it to. So who did Buddy Holly influence, or what would you say... Give me some examples of some influences Buddy Holly had.
I don't think anyone can listen to the, can hear the name Buddy Holly without thinking of Weezer at this point.
That song and that video, yeah, it's great. I mean, the song doesn't sound like Buddy Holly, but it's a cool song for sure.
Was that his style for the Buddy Holly video, just to make it look more 50s?
Well, Rivers Cuomo in those big stinking glasses, right? He's always got those big chunky glasses on. I think that's calculated. I don't think that's a mistake.
Then there was American Pie, like, The Day the Music Died was...
The movie?
The song, dude. American Pie?
Do they play the song American Pie in the movie American Pie?
I don't think so. But yeah, so Buddy Holly died in a plane crash with Ricky Valens, who sang... Was he La Bamba guy?
La Bamba! Yep. That's a great bass line, man. That whole song is great, actually.
Okay, and then the Big Bopper is like... What did the Big Bopper have?
I don't know. Like, the Big Bopper is probably, like, a rap name now.
You're right. I never pictured him as a white guy.
Like Rick Ross without a beard?
Kind of, yeah. Oh, Chantilly Lace. That is obviously a huge song. Yeah, all these guys died in the same plane crash. And then, thanks to Don McLean, he put together a little song about it. Want to hear it? Here go. And then there's a scene in my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, so Almost Famous, is that your... You've told me that's your favorite movie, right?
It's a movie about rock and roll. Yeah, it rocks pretty hard.
The writer guy, right? Like the Rolling Stone... Or the kid who pretends to be a Rolling Stone writer or something like that? Or he is a Rolling Stone writer.
Yeah, he's like super underage and he kind of like cheats his way to go write this super long article for Rolling Stone about an up-and-coming band, and he gets to travel with him and stuff. So it's pretty awesome.
What year did that come out?
2000? Yeah, it's a wonderful movie. But in the movie, there's a plane crash. Well, I don't want to give away too much. It's not a plane crash, but there is some turbulence. When everybody thinks they're going down, one of the guys kind of leans into the other. He's like, starts singing Peggy Sue in his ear. He's like, we're going to be the next Buddy Holly. It's kind of like spooky, but like it's one of those inside jokes that you wouldn't get unless you knew the whole Buddy Holly story.
All right, so... I picked the Sucky Song of the Day, which Steve calls this now the Sucky Song of the Day, which really explains why you're one of my best friends, because you want to call this the Sucky Song of the Day. So it does. So the Sucky Song of the Day was the number one hit in 1955. So Mitch Miller's The Yellow Rose of Texas. Let me just start off by apologizing for how sucky this song is. Let's just listen to this, Steve, and you can just kind of, let's just soak in the suck.
I don't want to soak in the suck. It's like a marching band song. What's wrong with that? It was all the rage back in 1955.
Yeah, well, apparently this guy, Mitch Miller, had a TV show full of sing-along songs. And so this is like one of those like sing-along songs. Like it's like a camp song. I was trying to find really terrible songs in the 50s, and this was like up there. I recognized the song immediately because there's a scene in the movie W about George W. Bush where he's not cutting it in the oil business. And it's just like a scene where he gives up on being an oilman. He like drinks a beer and he's like, I'm out of here. And this is a song they're playing. And it's just a really obnoxious song. So I'll just leave it at that. It's a march. Some may say a funeral march. I don't know why it exists. This guy also had other songs, like super generic songs with march beats. If you look up Mitch Miller Orchestra, it's just a giant collection of suck, and you should get his greatest hits and tie up your worst enemy in a room, play it full blast on your best hi-fi system, and they'll stop doing whatever they're doing to annoy you.
Okay, let me throw the other side of this story at you. Because this was 1955. This is before Elvis even came around. This was before rock music was even a thing. This was popular at the time. This song made it to number one.
You're making excuses for society's really terrible taste in music in the year 1955.
We should have been further than this.
We should have, yeah, this is just Pleasantville diarrhea soup. This is terrible. There's nothing good going on in this song. It's repetitive bullcrap, and I don't get it. Like, how could you... In 1955, there were other songs that had swing and had some kind of melody to it. This is just... Shut up. It's just a drum beat over and over again. And a freaking... what's it called? A piccolo? A piccolo. I'm listening to a piccolo on the radio. I would break my radio. And I would leave the country. And I'd take some dog skirts with me.
No, think about this. Think about the late 90s. After, you know, alternative music was... at its height, some might say, Celine Dion was still super popular. We've come so much further as music by then, but Celine Dion was holding us back. She was keeping us back in like the 80s love ballads time. And that's exactly what Mitch Miller Orchestras was doing at the time. It was the 50s and things were progressing and he's like, I'm gonna go old school on this one. I'm gonna mellow it out and I'm gonna make a marching tune. People are gonna love it.
I'm pretty sure that this was a giant surprise to Mitch Miller and everyone involved in the project when this song was popular. They were like, really? This shit's on the radio? Wow, people are deaf. All right, Mitch, let's write some more marching tunes and make a couple of records. I'm saying this completely out of line. For all I know, this guy was super, like, recognized. But I look at his picture, he looks like a Salvador Dali reject. I mean, I just can't picture this guy being popular. Like, I just don't get it, man.
I think someday we're going to look back and say the same thing about Celine Dion. How in the world was she ever popular when there was rock music to be had?
Well, if you just go to the YouTube page where the comments are, you've got G. Bridgman, number one song in 1955, as I recall. What are you, like 1,000 years old? Nice to hear it again. The Yellow Rose is a mulatto that kept Santa Ana busy and distracted, so he was defeated. Like, what is this history lesson I'm being taught? As a teenager, I used to watch his show every Sunday night.
Oh, that's it. He had a TV show.
Whatever. All I'm saying is that this had no swing. It was just tasteless pre-Beatles popular music, and I just hate it. Whatever. All right. That's it. And that being said, remember, subscribe, share, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Tumblr, Feedly, LinkedIn. Maybe not the last three. And remember to put the hashtag Face in Trouble. Steve, any last thoughts?
Nope.
Any last words?
Nope.
Any last considerations?
Nope.
All right.
All right.
All right. All right.
See you next week.
All right, yo. Follow. See you next week. Thanks.
Peace.
Got to get back. I need some get back.